I'm just briefly going to introduce Lester Thurow. I think most of you were here yesterday. And so I just commented to the lecturer, I think we have a negative fall-off rate. In other words, there are actually more people here today than yesterday, which is the opposite of what usually happens in series of lectures. So clearly the word has spread that these are lectures not to be missed. And I would just like to say on behalf of the Robbins family, how delighted we are to have Lester Thurow here to give these lectures. And if I can just say what I think Lionel Robbins would have said had he been here today, I think he would have said that these lectures remind him of one of the greatest economists in the whole classical canon, Adam Smith, because I think that what Lester is giving us is something that you find in Adam Smith, but not in very many of the other economists. The enormous global sweep of the lectures, the references to China, which are actually very frequent in Adam Smith. He never forgot that China was an enormous part of the globe and very important. The use of anecdotes from his own personal experience, and the emphasis on income distribution as being a key factor in the development of the world economy. In all these ways, I think Lionel would have said that Lester actually goes right back to the origins of the great economists in Adam Smith. So anyway, I don't want to turn his head, but he will now give you the second of these marvelous lectures. Now, I'm sorry there won't be very much time for questions because we have Archbishop Desmond Tutu coming afterwards. But there should be a little bit of time, nonetheless, before the next event at 7 o'clock. Yes.
As I said yesterday, what I'm going to talk about today is what I call the surface of the Earth, the things that are determined by plate tectonics, and the surface of the Earth is basically the distribution of purchasing power. And I'm going to spend most of the evening talking about the United States. And I do that for only two reasons. One reason is that the trends I'm going to talk about in the United States simply started earlier there and are stronger there, but we now see them everywhere. If you look at the income gap between the top decile and the bottom decile, that's now expanding in 12 of the 17 OECD countries that keep such records. And what I'm going to talk about started in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s, seems to have spread to Great Britain and the other Anglo-Saxon countries in the early 80s, is clearly spreading to the continent in the early 90s, and I think is going to be a general phenomenon in the first world. The other excuse for doing it on America is if you look at this kind of data, America has by far the best data. And we have it for a very peculiar reason. It had to do with the historical compromise around slavery. Because in the historical compromise, a slave counted as two-thirds of a citizen for determining representation. And so the United States had to have a census very early that asked detailed sociological data so we could deal with this complicated problem of slavery. Now, the interesting thing about the income distribution in the United States, and I want to give you a little history, because I'm going to say something, and you're probably going to say it's an exaggeration. And I want to try and press home that I don't think it is an exaggeration. I'm going to make the argument that if you look at the change in the distribution of purchasing power in the United States over the last 20 years, probably no country, and certainly no country in modern history, has ever had such a rapid change in the distribution of purchasing power without either a military defeat or a revolution. If you think about the distribution of income and wealth in the United States, prior to 1929, we have bits and pieces of information. After 1929, we have very elaborate annual surveys of the distribution of earnings and the distribution of income. The United States prior to that time was a peculiar country, because if you looked at the distribution of income and wealth, it was really two countries. The American South was giant plantations where a huge percentage of the population was slaves. And you would have had a very unequal distribution of income and wealth in the American South in the first 90 years of American history. The American North was completely the opposite, because it was an agricultural society of basically small farms where land had no value because there was an infinite supply of land. The only thing that gave land any value at all was transportation costs. Some pieces of land were closer to markets than others, but there was an infinite supply out there, which meant that basically nobody could be wealthy owning land in the United States the way you could be wealthy owning land in Europe. After the Civil War, it is highly likely that the American distribution of income, as the Industrial Revolution roared along, became noticeably more unequal. The famous robber barons of the late 19th century were, in fact, economically true. And that movement towards more inequality probably lasted into the early part of the 1920s. Because in the 1920s, it's important to remember that there was a big recession in agriculture that began long before the Great Depression. A reasonably large fraction of the population was still in agriculture, and so it's highly likely, based on all the data we have, that the American economy was moving towards inequality very strongly between Civil War time and the 1920s. But as I said, in 1929, we started measuring the data, and we have very good data after 1929, which means that it starts earlier in the United States than anywhere else. Now, the interesting thing is that in the 1930s, the American distribution of income and earnings moved substantially towards equality. And one level, that's not surprising, because if you have an economic collapse, whose income can go down the most? The answer is wealthy people. And in fact, there was a big movement back to the farms in the 1930s. People still had farm relatives, and so there was an income support program, essentially for low-income people, was go back to the farm where you at least eat. The more interesting phenomenon, however, is that movement towards inequality increased very sharply during World War II. Now, why it increased during World War II was not surprising. It was done with wage and price controls. Because during World War II, the feeling was that you had people out there fighting and dying in World War II. That was an egalitarian activity. And therefore, when the government set wages and prices, which it was doing in World War II, it should set wages and prices to create a more egalitarian distribution of income. So if you looked at the distribution of income and earnings in the United States during World War II, it moved very sharply towards equality. Now, the mystery is that when those wage and price controls were taken off at the end of World War II, it didn't go back to where it was. It stayed where the government put it. And if you look at the 50s and 60s, and we're teaching income distribution economics in the United States, as I was towards the end of the 60s, there was a major mystery. The mystery was, why is the American distribution of income essentially like Avogadro's constant? It never changes. You looked at any measure you wanted in that 20-year period of time, it was rock solid, nothing changing. Then suddenly in the late 1960s, something started to happen. The first thing that started to happen in the late 1960s is inequality started to rise. It started in certain groups first, but it spread very rapidly. And very quickly, we were into a world where in every group you look at, and in the American census you can look at lots of groups, hundreds of occupational titles, dozens of industrial titles, age, sex, demography groups like you can't believe, and in all of them, the distribution of earnings was moving towards inequality. And in 1993, if you look at the distribution of household income, we set an American record. It was the most unequal it has ever been since the statistics were measured. Starting 5 or 6 years later in 1973, real wages started to fall for many males. And here again, that fall in real wages started and gradually spread until today. Wages are falling for all male educational classifications, including people with graduate degrees, and they're falling for all female classifications except women with college educations. Now, it's important to be very clear. When I talk about falling wages, I'm talking about median wages. Because remember, as I said yesterday, over this same period of time, 1973 to 1993, the per capita GNP has gone up 33%. So if you look at means, they have to be going up. If you look at medians, they're going down. And the question is, what's going on? Now remember, as I said, this is a trend that started earlier in the United States, seems to be stronger in the United States, but you now see this trend spreading around the industrial world. You remember the statistic I gave you yesterday. If you look at non-supervisory workers, everybody who doesn't boss anybody else and works in the American economy, their real weekly wages in that period of time when the real per capita income was going up 33% went down 20%. With almost monotonous regularity, 1% a year. Very little variance around that 1% a year over that 20-year period of time. And this is not a phenomenon that just relates to minorities, women, fringe workers. If you look at year-round, full-time, white male workers, and in American statistics, that means you work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. White male, their real income over this period of time has gone down 10%. So we're not talking about something that's happening on the fringes of the economy by adding a lot of fringe workers to the economy. We're talking about something that's happening at the core of the economy. Now, over here on the board, I put some statistics just so that you can see them and remember them. FTFY means full-time, full-year males, earnings. What's happened to them quintile by quintile, starting the quintile number one is the poorest quintile in America of male workers. Quintile number five is the richest quintile of American workers. And notice those numbers, remembering the 33% up when you look at the per capita GNP. Minus 23, minus 21, minus 15, minus 10, plus 10, with all the income gains going to the top 20% of the population. But let me give you the mind-boggling statistic. If you take that top 20% of the population that got the income gains, how much of those total income gains do you think went to the top 1%? 64%. 64% of all the wage gains for all the males in America over this 20-year period of time accrued to the top 1% of the population. And if you look at income as opposed to earnings, the number is 90%. 90% of all the income increases in America, capital income plus wage income, went to the top 1% of males. That's why I say that probably no society in peacetime, without a military occupation, without a revolution, has ever had that kind of a shift in the distribution of income. And the shift has been strongest for young people. Let me give you some statistics about young people. Once again, I'm going to look at full-time, full-year workers. So I've gotten rid of all the unemployed, all the students, all the part-times. I'm simply going to look at 18 to 24-year-old men and women who work all year long and what's happened to their earnings over this period of time. Recently, the United States Census Bureau has done a study where they asked how many young people can work all year long and still make less in a year's work than $12,195. Now, the reason they picked that number in $1,990 is that's a number that's kind of halfway between the American poverty line for a family of three and a family of four. And what it means is if you can't earn that sum of money and you're working full time, you can never expect to support a family. And so how many of the young men and young women in America are we basically telling economically, you are not going to be economically capable of supporting a family? Well, if you go back to 1973, let me first look at young men, you will find that in 1973, 18% of the young men in America could work all year long and made less than that sum of money. That, of course, meant 82% made more. What do you think that number is today? The 18%. 44%. Now, these are basically the high school graduates who don't go to university because they're the people who are the full-time workers in the workforce. And if we oriented it into part-timers, the unemployed, obviously the numbers would be worse. If you look at young females, the percentages go up from 29 to 52. Almost half the young men, and slightly more than half the young men, and slightly more than half the young women in America can work full-time and not earn a poverty-line income for a family between three and four people. That's a very devastating message. At the same time, if you looked at the average salary of CEOs in America relative to the lowest paid full-time worker in their companies, that was a ratio which in 1974 was 35 to 1. The average CEO in America made 35 times as much as the lowest paid full-time worker in their company. What do you think that ratio is today? 150 to 1 over a 20-year period of time. That's why I say that probably no society has ever had a sharper movement in the distribution of income and earnings towards inequality in a shorter period of time. Now, something else happened in this environment. A movement towards downsizing occurred. If you looked at downsizings, and downsizings are basically defined as Fortune 500 companies who announce that they're going to cut the size of their workforce. There have been two ways of downsizing in America. In the late early 1990s, 1991, 92, there was a wave of downsizing by major American corporations who were losing money during the recession. Announced downsizings went from 300,000 workers in 1990 to 550,000 workers in 1991 to 400,000 workers in 1992. And it was unusual because American firms were downsizing a very different group. In the 1981-82 recession, 90% of the people laid off were blue-collar workers. And most of them were laid off on temporary recalls. In the 91-92 recession, only 30% of the people laid off were blue-collar workers. The rest were white-collar and managers. And essentially, nobody was laid off on a temporary recall. They were all laid off permanently. But the more interesting phenomenon was starting in 93, 94, and presumably going into 95, we started to have a second wave of downsizings. This wave of downsizing was interesting because it occurred among firms that were already profitable. They did not have to do it from the point of view of economic necessity. In 1993, we set a record of 600,000 downsizings announced, and in January of 1994, 1 month, 104,000 downsizings were announced in a 30-day period of time. And you see something sweeping through middle management and white-collar workers that has never swept through it before. And what we've basically done is we have destroyed the implicit post-World War II social contract. Because the implicit post-World War II social contract between labor and management is if you work hard and perform on an individual basis, and if you learn what we tell you to learn, and if you move where we tell you to move, and if the company's profitable, you'll have a lifetime job with this company and annual real wage increases. That social contract is dead. Because the companies are now saying is you can work very hard, be a very good individual, you can learn what you're supposed to learn, you can move where we tell you to move, and we will still lay you off. And you will get no real wage increases for most Americans. And if you look at the people downsized, they took enormous cuts in income for those who got reemployed. If you look at the people downsized in the first wave of downsizing, 12% of them ended up exiting the labor force forever. They were never again reemployed. And 17% remained unemployed 2 years later. Permanently exit means you give up even looking. 17% were still looking. Of the 71% who had found reemployment, 31% had to take a wage reduction of more than 25% to get reemployed. 32% had a wage reduction between 1 and 25%, and 37% found employment at their old wage rate. Now, in the second wave of downsizing, we don't yet have systematic data. We just have bits and pieces. We do have a survey of the people downsized at RJR Nabisco. There, 72% eventually found reemployment, but on average, they had to take a 47% cut in wages to get reemployed. Almost cut their wages in half. And at the same time, part of that implicit social contract was if you work for a good company, a Fortune 500 company, that company is going to give you some fringe benefits, pensions and health care. And what we see happening very rapidly in the United States is pensions and health care programs being eliminated. In the 10-year period from 1979 to 1989, the percentage of the American workforce with a private pension plan declined from 50 to 43%. And the percentage of the private workforce with a health insurance plan declined from 69 to 61% of the population of the system. Now, take a look at that second set of numbers. That second set of numbers is household income, quintile by quintile, -3, -3, -0.5%, +6, +16. How can that happen, given what's going on with male wages? The bottom 60% of the population lost a little bit, but they essentially held even. And the top 40% of the population in real terms had a little bit of an increase in income. Top 20% did very well, and if we looked at the top 1%, they did very, very well. The answer, of course, had to be that the American woman came to the rescue of the American male. During this period of time, women went to work and worked many more hours per year. And if you look at female annual earnings, they rose 33% in real terms. The problem was that only about a third of that was wage increases, and two-thirds of it was more hours of work. And so basically, females went to work, especially in the bottom 60% of the population, and their extra work effort compensated for their loss in their husband's income. The problem going forward is that women, especially married to males in the bottom 60% of the population, are now already working full-time. They have no capability of basically adding to their annual hours of work and supplementing family income by working harder. And the other problem is that in the 70s and much of the 80s, real female wages were rising, but in the 90s, with the exception of college-educated females, real female wages are falling, like their husband's wages are falling. And so looking forward, you're apt to see a big change in the distribution of household income in the decade ahead. Now that's partly also if you believe in selective mating. In selective mating, people who are alike marry each other. In every place we can measure characteristics, people selectively mate. If you're in the 90th percent of the height distribution, you're very apt to marry a spouse who's in the 90th or close to its percentage of the height distribution. And that presumably means that the man who's making $300,000 a year is probably married to the woman who could potentially make $300,000 a year, and the man who makes $5,000 a year is potentially married to the woman who can make $5,000 a year. And if the women haven't been going to work and go to work, you create inequality. Now, what happened is that low-income women went to work first, compensated for their husband's loss in income. We're now in a period of time where if you look at female participation rates, the only people who can add to their participation rates are basically women married to high-income males, and we're apt to see a movement towards inequality from that also. Now that's the American data. I would like to argue to you that the same fundamental plate tectonics was affecting Europe, but it showed up in a different way. In Europe, it basically shows up because of the social institutions and unemployment. In 1970, the unemployment rate in Europe was half that of the United States. In 1995, the unemployment rate in Europe is more than twice that of the United States. And what Europe basically decided to do was to protect the wages of the employed. And by protecting the wages of the employed, they created a world where nobody would invest in new jobs. And they created a group of unemployed people who have zero earnings. And of course, they were compensated with a generous social welfare system. But the same fundamental plate tectonics that explains falling wages in the United States explains rising unemployment in Europe. Now, people can argue that in some places like Spain or Italy, that a lot of the so-called measured unemployment, and there are four countries in Europe where the unemployment rate is four times that of the United States, Ireland, Spain, Finland, one other, that if you look at that unemployment rate, you're seeing the same fundamental phenomenon. Now, the Southern Europeans say, hey, some of our unemployed people are really working in the black economy, and they get measured as unemployment, but they're really not unemployed. That's probably true, but in Northern Europe, it's the opposite. If you go to the Netherlands, 15% of the males who ought to be in the workforce because of the right age to be in the workforce are officially on health disability and out of the workforce and don't get counted as unemployed. Put them back into the workforce, you got another country in Europe that undoubtedly has a real unemployment rate above 20%, the Netherlands. The other thing you see in Europe, of course, is the unemployed stay unemployed for very long periods of time. In France, 39% of all the people unemployed have been unemployed for more than a year. In Germany, it's 46%. In Ireland, it's 60%. In the United States, it's less than 10%. And of course, there's a reason for it. If you look at the unemployed in America, only a third of them get any unemployment insurance payments whatsoever. And if you look at the third who get unemployment insurance payments, it only replaces 40% of their previous wage income. In the United States, you have no choice but to take the first job offered to you, even if the wage rate is a 50% cut in your wages, because there's very little of a social support system that allows you to sit there waiting for a better job offer to come along. Now, if you look at Europe, I think what you're debating in Europe at the moment is whether you want to transfer that plate tectonic pressure from the unemployment sphere to the wage sphere. And I think you see it shifting on the continent. It has already shifted in Great Britain. In 1993, for the first time, German real wages fell 1%. And I don't know if you noticed it, but if you were reading your French newspaper right after Christmas, IBM France, that has 14,000 employees, had a Christmas surprise. They announced that the 14,000 employees had voted with a 95% majority to take a 7.7% wage cut. Because the choice was take a 7.7% wage cut or find most of your jobs eliminated. And IBM didn't bother to consult the French unions. They were completely bypassed in that operation. The European Commission now talks about labor market flexibility. Labor market flexibility is a code word for falling wages. In Japan, you don't yet see these trends in the data except for one thing. The Japanese essentially run a private unemployment insurance scheme where you stay on the payroll even though the company doesn't need you. And the Japanese companies will tell you that they have at least 10 to 15% of their workforce who they would fire if they were American companies, which puts Japanese unemployment rates, if anything, in real terms, as high or higher than European unemployment rates. Because the Japanese are like the Europeans, they basically haven't let real wages fall. The other thing we're developing is something which Marx would recognize as the lumpen proletariat. People who the productive process has no interest in whatsoever. We call them the homeless. I remember when homelessness first started to break out in the United States in the late 1970s, my European friends all said to me, "That's America. You guys have got a lousy social welfare system, lousy education system, you don't give a damn, and it produces homelessness." Well, what do I now notice? I don't just notice homelessness in London. I notice people sleeping in the streets of the steps of the cathedral in Cologne. And the last time I was in Japan, and I go out running because of jet lag in the middle of the night, I am running through the around the Imperial Palace through one of the Imperial Parks, and there are 40 people sleeping on park benches. I counted them. The French estimate they have 600,000 to 800,000 homeless people. I don't know how many you estimate in Great Britain. It's a worldwide phenomenon. And there's something else very interesting in the United States. There are a whole group of people who, in terms of the regular production process, have just disappeared. If you go back to the 1950s and look at males, because you've got changing female participation rates, and you say, given those participation rates by age, and let's look at 25 to 54-year-olds, people who ought to be in the workforce. They're the right age. They're out of school. They're not early enough to get any retirement program. Relative to what was happening in the 1950s, 5.8 million American males have disappeared. They've either been dropped out of the economy or they have dropped out of the economy. They just aren't there. They're not unemployed. They're not looking for work. They're the lumpen proletariat. Now, the facts are very clear. What about the causes? Well, I think the answer is the causes are murky and not so clear because it relates to a very complicated interaction of those five plates. And I think we know what's causing it, but as yet we don't have. You can't say, well, it's 15% this and 20% that. One thing we know that's happening. Take all those jobs in America. From 1973 to 1993, the American economy generated 33 million jobs. From 1980 to today, the American economy has generated 18 million jobs. And essentially, every single one of them is in the service sector. And on average, jobs in the service sector pay one-third less than the average American job. There's some high-wage jobs in the service sector, the hired guns in the financial markets, but there are a lot of low-wage jobs. And if you add 33 million jobs that are paid a third less than existing labor, you obviously pull down the average. And about a third of the decline in wages can be traced to this enormous growth in the service economy and the fact that in the United States, the service economy pays wages much lower than the rest of the economy. Now, that isn't true, especially in continental Europe, where social legislation, union negotiations prevent that from happening. And so they haven't developed a service economy, or they haven't developed a labor-intensive service economy. And you see it very clearly if you compare how things are done on the continent in the United States. In parking lots in America, we have somebody at the gate paid the minimum wage or less. How many people do you think stand at the gates of parking lots in Sweden? Essentially zero. It's all done with cards and machines. Go to an American ski resort and a Swiss ski resort and you'll see something very different. Swiss ski resort is highly automated, selling tickets automatically, having the lift set up so one person can watch more than one lift. You go to an American ski resort, you're going to see a lot of labor. And the difference is, at the wage rates you can pay in the United States, people are cheaper than machines. At the wage rates you have to pay in continental Europe, machines are cheaper than people. Now, if you look at the economic literature and what's going on, you will find that there are two sets of articles. And they're very peculiar sets of articles. Because each set of articles says, it can't be what I've just investigated, and therefore it must be X. While the other one says, it can't be what I've just investigated, and therefore it must be Y. And the two things in the literature are factor price equalization and a skill-intensive shift in technology. Now, the factor price equalization argument is very simple. The argument is, we've had, as I mentioned yesterday, 7.8 million legal immigrants to the United States in a decade, all relatively unskilled. 2 or 3 more million illegal immigrants. You've had a huge increase in imports from third world countries that have made big changes in some industries like automobiles that used to pay high wages for high school graduates and high school dropouts. And that has to push down wages for labor. The technology argument is, because of these new information technologies, just-in-time inventory, statistical quality control, you've got to have a better educated workforce at the bottom of the factory. And as I mentioned yesterday, if you go to the new automobile plants in the United States, they don't hire high school graduates, they don't hire high school dropouts. They'll hire people who at least have a little junior college education. And you've got a skill-intensive technological shift. Now, what's the argument for it can't be factor price equalization? The argument for it can't be factor price equalization basically is that if it was factor price equalization, it means the wages of skilled workers go up relative to unskilled worker, and what's a business firm supposed to do? It's supposed to substitute against the skilled workers, and since skilled workers have become relatively more expensive, if you went out there in the economy, you should see a diminishing use of skilled workers. Problem, of course, is you don't see that. We're increasing the use of skilled workers, and therefore, this set of articles say it must be technology. The problem, of course, is we believe we're developing a global economy. How can you develop a global economy and not have factor price equalization? How can you have 10 million immigrants and not have factor price equalization? If you really believe this argument is true, you've got a major mystery. The argument that it can't be technology is equally convincing. If it was technology, How could the wages of the most skilled people in America be falling? It's supposed to be a skill using technology shift, yet we've got every skill, the highest skill levels. Real wages are falling. And if it is technologies, what are the technologies that are having this enormous impact? You can point to things, but none of them seem to be big enough to explain this kind of an effect. So what is it? Factor price equalization is skill incentive shift in technology. Now remember, those both come from the plates that we were talking about yesterday. Now, it could be both, obviously, but there's a problem. And this problem has always been one of the major mysteries in American economics, and that is, when you go out to find those equilibrium wages, they don't seem to exist. Because if you look at the variance in the American distribution of income, you can go to the finest classifications we have of observationally equivalent workers. And you'll find, you know, so you can have a certain occupation, a certain industry, full-time work, male, 25 to 34 years of age. You're correct for everything you can think of, everything we measure, and we measure lots of things. And you will still find the variance within that supposedly homogeneous group is almost as big as the variance for the entire population. And the problem is, if you look at this enormous increase in inequality, 70% of it is within group variance increase of people who are exactly alike. Their incomes are spreading, or earnings are spreading out enormously when they're observationally equivalent. So the question is, what's going on? What makes it work? Now I think if you look at that argument that various economists have made, that it can't be factor price equalization, the problem is, for now, they're focusing on the wrong factor price equalization. Because the argument is basically focused on the proposition, are imports from third world countries essentially having an impact on wages? And one of the counter arguments is they're simply too small to have that kind of impact. I think, in fact, what you're having at the moment is what I would call factor price equalization among the OECD countries. And that's why you see it most clearly in the United States. Because in the early 1970s, wages in America were much higher than the rest of the OECD. In Great Britain, you see the same increase in inequality, but not the falling real wages, because Britain was, in fact, one of the lowest wage countries in the OECD. You didn't have to lower British real wages in order to have factor price equalization among the OECD. And you did Americans. And if you start thinking about OECD imports, they are plenty big enough to cause the observed effect. And of course, it's exactly where they've happened. If you look at those white males, where have they taken their biggest losses? Automobiles, machine tools, steel. Where do those imports come from? Japan, which in 1970 had wages way below those of the United States. Now, the interesting thing about that factor price equalization that came out of the OECD is you have to understand that if you look at the distribution of earnings in the United States, it's somewhat different than a country like either Germany or Japan. Basically, we run a society, if you look at the average American firm, about 12% of its workforce is managers and professionals. The average German firm, only about 6% of their workforce is managers and professionals. And what we use all those managers and professionals for in the same industry, what we use all those managers and professionals for in the United States is to basically dumb down the production process so you can use more unskilled workers. The Germans skill up their basic workforce, which allows them to run with a smaller cadre of managers and professionals. And of course, if you looked at the United States during this period of time in the 1970s and said, who was overpaid? It was essentially that automobile worker. Relative to the rest of the world. He wasn't as skilled as the German, and he was making a hell of a lot more money than the German or the Japanese. And I think you see that very clearly if you look at the data. Because what most people have focused on is that if you looked at wages, college wages have gone up relative to high school wages dramatically. The wage premium that a college graduate gets over a high school graduate in the United States over this period of time has gone up from about 35% to 90%. But what do you think has happened to high school dropouts and people with less than an eighth grade education? Their earnings have risen relative to high school graduates over the same period of time. The bottom of the economy has gained relative to high school graduates. The top of the economy has gained relative to high school graduates. And the high school graduates have basically been squeezed down the distribution. The high school graduates weren't squeezed by the third world. They were basically squeezed by the OECD world. And what's happened in this kind of an operation is we're producing a very different distribution of earnings. Now, if you take classical comparative advantage, what are you supposed to import? Labor-intensive products, if you're a rich industrial country like the United States. So if you looked at import competing industries in the United States, you'd expect to see wages which were certainly lower than wages in the general economy, and you'd expect certainly to see wages which were lower than the exporting industries. What do you actually find in the United States? You can take input-output data, grind through what the wage rate is in the import competing industries, the exporting industries, and the total workforce, leaving out imports and exports, and what do you find? Well, the last time we had a complete input-output table was 1983, but in that year, the wage in the import competing industry was $19,583. The wage in the exporting industries was $18,637. And the wages for the whole economy was $16,168. The import industry was the competing industry were, in fact, the highest wage industries in America. And that's not surprising if you think about what we're importing. Automobiles, steel, machine tools. Those were the highest wage industries imports in America. Now, so what we basically had in the United States is this factor price equalization in the middle. Not at the bottom, in the middle. And of course, that's why, as I mentioned yesterday, the political revolution against the Democrats and Bill Clinton came from white, high school educated males. It's a little bit like the movie Network. Throw open the window, put your head out and scream, I'm mad as hell. Because something bad's happened to me. Now the question is, where did all that increase in variance come from? I think the problem is that you've got to think about the labor market very differently than we do in classical economics. Suppose you have two things, a distribution of bones, and you have a distribution of dogs that have bone hunting ability. And each dog gets only one bone. What determines the distribution of income? The distribution of bone hunting ability or the distribution of bones? The distribution of bones determines it. The dogs can be absolutely equivalent, and you will still have a distribution as unequal as the initial distribution of bones. Or you can have dogs with enormous differences in their ability to find bones, and if every bone is exactly the same, you're going to have an egalitarian economy despite this enormous difference in talent. I would like to argue to you that, and I did in a book in the mid-1970s called Generating Inequality, the bones are jobs. And we, in fact, distribute people with identical talents across a very different distribution of bones. And that's what explains that enormous within-group variance. If I'm a sweeper for a good company, let's see, IBM in the old days, I get paid a very different wage than if I am a hallway sweeper for a bad company in America. Same job, very different wage. Now, what happens in a world? The other thing you have to understand about the labor market is it's a world of asymmetric elasticities. Presumably, a college graduate, unless you believe we learn something that hurts us, is a perfect substitute for a high school graduate. He or she can do everything that somebody with less education can do, but it doesn't work the other way. The high school graduate is not a perfect substitute for a college graduate. So you've got a world of asymmetric elasticities. What happens in that world if you just pushed into the system an increase in the supply of college labor? The answer is not that the wage of college workers goes down. The answer is the college workers take what used to be the best high school jobs. And the distribution of college earnings spreads out. The high school workers take what used to be the best high school dropout jobs. The distribution of high school income spreads down, and whether they could become wider or lower depends on what part of the densities of the distribution you're working in. I call that model a job competition model in the mid-1970s. And what's happened in this kind of a world, I think, is you get these pressures. We had a huge increase in the supply of college-educated workers. We had an enormous increase in immigration. We have a lot of factor price equalization among the OECD countries. And what you see is that bumping in the workforce, which creates that within-group variance, which is where all the action is. And so this, despite the fact that all the action is within the group, I would argue that doesn't prove that it's not technology or it's not factor price equalization. Now, I think it's highly likely that it's a combination of both. And I think it's also true that at the moment we don't know the exact proportions. But we do know one thing. Whatever you think the degree of factor price equalization was in the past, it's going to increase. Because we've got the second world, which is well educated, joining the first world, and we're going to have a huge increase in the supply of relatively well educated workers. And so even if you came to the conclusion that there was no factor price equalization from the third world affecting the first world in the last 20 years, I think that's very unlikely to be true in the next 20 years. Same thing, of course, is true for technology. If you think we had a technological skill-using shift in technology in the last 20 years, everything I argued yesterday says it's going to speed up. And those forces are going to get stronger, not less. Now, if you think of something other than factor price equalization and a skill-intensive technology shift, let me mention some other things that may explain some of the data. This implicit social contract. Why do you think it was that people were willing to recognize unions? Might have been that the capitalists were scared. They're not scared anymore. We see something very dramatic in the United States. In the 1950s, in the private economy, about 40% of the workforce was unionized. Today, it's less than 10%. And that hasn't happened by accident. There has been a deliberate campaign hiring consulting companies that are specialists in crushing unions to get unions out of your company. And it's worked. Because with inflation, some companies have even learned that you can violate the law, because the penalties for violating the law are fines which are so small you just pay them every day and ignore it. And we've had several famous cases where companies have done that. Just pay the fine and ignore the law. Now, there's a big argument in the literature as to whether unions raise or lower real wages. There's no argument in the literature about their egalitarian impact. Companies with unions have a narrower distribution of wages than companies without them. And so when you get rid of them, even if you don't change the average wage, you spread the wage out on all levels. Managers get paid less relative to workers in companies, which there are unions, and you've got that kind of bargaining power. A second thing that may be hitting the system may be a recorded deterioration in an unrecorded deterioration in education. Suppose you're letting people through high school who in the good old days you wouldn't let through high school. The employer knows that. You can't kid the employer about the skills of the worker. But in the statistics, they get recorded as a high school graduate where they used to be recorded as a high school dropout. It doesn't change their wages one bit, but it spreads out the distribution of high school graduate incomes or earnings, simply because you're recording some people in that category that really ought not to be there. Deregulation has clearly had a big impact in certain industries, because there's no question that with government regulation, the monopoly rents that came from the government regulation were shared with the workforce. You see it very clearly in trucking and airlines in the United States. Probably the most radical example was TWA. In the regulated era, they paid their average stewardess about $35,000 to $40,000. The day they were deregulated, they lowered it to $17,000. Stewardesses were getting the benefit of the monopoly rents from deregulation. Same thing happened with truck drivers. When the trucking industry was deregulated, there was an enormous downward adjustment in the wages for truck drivers. One of the things that may be hitting the system that may be as important as imports, if you look at these mid-skill high-wage industries, automobiles, steel, and machine tools, the fact of the matter is those industries are the industries which in recent years have had the fastest rate of growth of productivity, and the rate of growth of productivity is faster than the rate of growth of demand. And they would have been laying people off even if there had been no imports. It's dramatic in steel. There you've got two things going on. You've got productivity going on in the sense of being able to produce steel with much less workers. You've also had a dramatic shift in the sense we build everything with a lot less steel than we used to. Way back in 1960, we used 120 million tons of steel in the United States. The economy is not twice as big, almost twice as big today, and we use 97 million tons of steel. You know how many hours of work it now takes an American car company to build a car? 18 hours. Think about that. When you buy a car, you're buying no labor. Even at $20 an hour, less than $400 out of your $20,000 that you pay for the car is the workers who work for the automobile companies. You can argue that macroeconomics may have played a role. We have, in fact, been willing to tolerate, on a worldwide basis, much lower rates of growth in the 70s than we had in the 60s, the 80s than we had in the 70s, the 90s than we had in the 80s. In the United States, we may have had a big impact from the baby boom generation. If you have a baby, what are you implicitly promising to do? Implicitly, you're promising about 20 years later to save enough money to equip that baby with a normal amount of capital so they can have the average American income. And when we had our baby boom between 1947 and 1963, American parents essentially were making that implicit promise, but they didn't live up to it. Capital-labor ratios in the late 70s and the early 80s were falling in the United States because the workforce was rising faster than the capital stock. Now, what we told ourselves at that time is, well, that's temporary, because by the mid-1980s, the baby boom will all be in the workforce, the baby dearth comes behind them, and capital-labor ratios will once again start to rise. It didn't happen because of immigration. Immigration was so high that we continued to have a period of time where capital-labor ratios fell for the economy as a whole, and of course the way they fell is not that you're using less capital in the automobile industry, but you can create this enormous service sector that's uncapitalized and has very little capital in it. One of the other things that happened, of course, is that you need to make the distinction between wages and fringe benefits. But the problem is, in the United States anyway, when you talk about fringe benefits, they don't go to the guys who are working. For example, in the automobile industry, the cash wage is about $15 an hour. The automobile companies will tell you that their labor cost is $28 an hour because there's $13 worth of fringe benefits. The problem is the fringe benefits are not going into a fund where they're accumulating for the benefit of current workers. They're going to pay health care for people already retired or to fund unfunded pension liabilities. And so one of the things we see is that you've got all of these payments going to the elderly for health care and pensions in the private sector as well as the public sector. And so from the point of view of the corporation, the wage bill hasn't gone down, but from the point of view of the individual worker, the wage bill has gone down. Now, I think when you look at all of these things, you would say there's plenty there to explain what went on, especially if you're willing to understand that these famous equilibrium wages don't exist in our modern industrial economies. It's the distribution of bones that count, not the distribution of bone-hunting abilities. Looking forward, what's the problem? Looking forward, of course, is that any impact you think that's going to come out of the second world joining the first world is ahead of us and not behind us. Whatever impact you think came out of the third world, there were very few countries that were export-oriented in the third world in the last couple of decades, and we're now up to a place where there's an enormous number of third world people who are interested in being export-oriented, and that pressure is going to increase. And one of the volcanoes or earthquakes I will talk about tomorrow is very simple. Societies have existed successfully for very long periods of time, hundreds and thousands of years, with enormous inequalities. but they have always done it in an environment where they had an ideology that justified those inequalities. Nobody in Rome, Imperial Rome, ever preached egalite. Nobody ever in the Middle Ages expected their children to have a higher standard of living than they had. It was a very different set of expectations. And we've got two problems. One, of course, is our official ideology is democracy. That's egalite. One person, one vote. How do you put a system of, in some sense, radical egalite, democracy, together with a system of complete inegalite, or a system moving rapidly towards inegalite? Logically, there's no conflict between capitalism and slavery. There is a conflict between slavery and democracy. The way we've done that in the last 20, 30 years was to use the social welfare state as essentially the device for correcting the inequality of the market economy. We did that by pumping education into the system. We did that with social welfare benefits. But as I argued yesterday, that device we no longer have. What happens when you can't deliver the goods? The economy can't deliver a wage rate that's rising for a majority of the voters, and the government can't correct the situation. It doesn't have the instruments at its hand that would allow it to do it. It's a good question. I'm not sure I have an answer. Thank you. Okay, before the bishop shows up, we have a little time for discussion.
Right, thank you very much. Like a good TV serial, you've left us all on the edge of our seats waiting for the next installment and the answer to the question, which we may or may not get tomorrow. But who would like to ask a question now? Yes.
I'll repeat the question so everybody can hear it. Well, you know, the question is, what about the second world that's making this transition? Are they going to try and follow the first world or some other model? Remember, when the Soviet Union first collapsed, the Swedes were still talking about the third way. There is no third way. The Swedes are now having to move from their third way to, in some sense, the Anglo-Saxon first way, because their social welfare state, being the most expensive, has probably collapsed in the most fundamental way. They got a deficit, which is a fraction of GNP, I think is 14% of the GDP. They're going to have to make enormous cutbacks in that social welfare state. And so, you know, if you say, what is the third way? Now, you've got a problem. I'm unhappy. How do I have a revolution when there's no revolutionary ideology? I don't think I can. There were a lot of people unhappy in the Middle Ages, but around what banner did they rally? There was no banner to rally. And so what you see is a very high level of discontent, but it has no focus. And I think the same thing's true if you look at the second world. Now, you've got to be careful here. If you think about factor price equalization, if I live in China, it's the greatest thing that ever happened, positively. Because I start out with a per capita income of $400. You start out in the United States with a per capita income of $25,000, my income goes up, your median income goes down, and if you were kind of looking at the world in a cosmic sense, you'd say the world was better, right? Redistributing a little wage from Americans to Chinese makes the world a better place, but it doesn't make Americans happy. The guys who've got to do the redistribution. The problem at the moment is, if you think about, does anybody know how to run a good firm, an efficient firm, on non-capitalistic basis? I think the answer at the moment is we don't. Now, the interesting thing in the United States is there are a few firms that are successful running not as capitalist firms, but very few. And the question, one of the mysteries is, why do we have a world where capital hires labor as opposed to a world where labor hires capital? The one great counterexample in the United States is United Parcel. Very successful American firm for a very long period of time, and it's essentially socialism. The workers own it. They get relatively low wages, but they get a lot of stock options. They aren't listed on the stock exchange because they aren't owned by anybody but the workforce, but they have a synthetic stock index, and on the day you retire, you're given your stock options in cash, and the minute you leave the company, you can't own anything, any shares of the company. And they've had truck drivers who've retired with as much as $1 million. Now, those truck drivers had to work for 45 years to get their $1 million, but they've been able to organize a company which basically runs on a socialist basis in a capitalist economy. But they're the great exception. The rule is something very different. And I suspect you're going to find the same thing in the second world. Now, who runs good state companies? Well, the answer is there are some good state companies run around the world, but the ones that are run around the world run exactly like capitalist companies, and you wouldn't know any difference if you work for them. They pay their workers the same, they act the same, they lay them off the same, the executives get paid the same. They may be owned by the government, but they're not what 19th century socialists meant by socialism. They're just capitalism where the state happens to own all the shares. And even there are very few of them. So I think the answer is, at the moment, unless somebody discovers it, there is no third way.
We have a question down here.
It seems like it's the economy is at play, it's people's expectations, how do you lower people's expectations in the future?
Well, when I was the question is, how do you lower expectations? When I was a graduate student, I was once told by a Japanese friend that was the difference between Western economics and Eastern economics. In Western economics, we say, how do we get production up to the level of your expectations? In Eastern economics, we say, how do we get expectations down to the level of production? The fact of the matter, however, and this is something I'm going to talk a little bit on Thursday, we're running a system that does exactly the opposite. Because if you think of this wired global village, the television set is a very peculiar thing. Who works on television? Other than policemen. Nobody. The society that people spend most of their life watching doesn't work. The other thing that's interesting about that society, and people have done studies of this in the United States, what's the average, who do you invite into your house the most? Well, the television set. How do you, the average person doesn't read census statistics. How does the average person how wealthy or how high an income the average American family has, based on the TV set. Now, they know the TV set exaggerates it, and so they lower their estimate a little bit, but nowhere near enough. In the United States, if you look at the programs that we show on TV, and you look at the furniture, the cars, how they're spending their money, you can make an estimate of what income, implicit income, they all must have. And if you average across the entire set of television networks, the average family on TV has an income about 4 times the actual average. And so even if I cut it in half, I'm still twice too high. And Americans have a very exaggerated view as to how wealthy Americans are, and therefore you're keeping up with the mythological Joneses, who don't really exist, but you see these very elaborate consumption standards of living, styles of living on TV, and there's an effort to keep up. One of the things that is interesting is in every OECD country, savings rates have fallen over the last 20 years, with no exception. Even people who are frugal savers, like the Japanese, save less than they used to save. Question is why? Some people have been willing to argue, and I think there must be something into it. It has to do with this culture, because the other thing that's interesting about the TV culture is it spends no time investing in the future. None whatsoever. It's a now culture. And if you blast people with a now consumption culture day after day, and the average American TV sets on 8 hours a day,
Doesn't mean somebody's watching it, but it's on 8 hours a day. It's got to have an impact. And so I think the basic problem in terms of lowering expectations is we're running a wired village, which, if anything, will raise expectations as opposed to lower expectations.
Now, we have time for one or two more questions. Anybody up in the gallery? Nobody's asked one yet. Well, perhaps we better make this the last question, if I can put one to you from the chair. I think some people would say that perhaps there is an ideology which goes along with the developments you've been describing. We used to call it Thatcherism, perhaps you called it Reaganism, the enterprise economy, equality of opportunity rather than actual income. I think you recognize the kind of ideology I'm talking about. Does it still hold, and is it going to, as it were, avoid the revolution?
No, I don't think it computes. First of all, I don't think there's a revolution, because you can't have a revolution without an ideology. There is no ideology. But see, that's not what Ronald Reagan told us. Ronald Reagan told us that maybe we would have to tolerate some wider income inequalities, but in return for that toleration, we would all get faster real wage gains. Inequality might go up, but real wages would rise faster. The first part was delivered without the second. But Reagan portrayed the first as a cost, not as a benefit. It was a necessary cost to get the benefit. Well, in some sense, we paid the necessary cost, but most Americans didn't get the benefit. Think about that statistic. 64% of all the wage increases in the United States in a period of time when the per capita income goes up 34% in real terms accrues to the top 1% of the population. It's mind-boggling. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Lester Theorot very much for that wonderful, stimulating lecture. But I have bad news for you. Those of you who are sitting here waiting to hear Archbishop Tutu, I'm sorry, you have to leave the hall. Everyone has to leave the hall. It has to be searched by security, and then you can all come back in. Sorry.